honor today to take up the matter of comets, the breakup of comets. They seem to have something to say regarding the age of things. Now, you're very familiar with what a comet looks like. Seems like in the last few years, we've had a number of naked eye comets in the sky. By that I mean comets that you can see, you know, without the use of a telescope or binoculars for at least part of their trip around the sun. There was the comet Kohoutek, you know, that was rather famous and looked like it was going to be tremendously spectacular, and it was spectacular. Not quite up to predictions after it swung around the perihelion point, the point of closest approach to the sun, but nonetheless was plenty spectacular. Then there was very recently the comet West, which you could get a look at if you got out at a certain part of the year, certain time, and took a look at the sky. You could even see that one with the naked eye. Very beautiful comet, too. So you know what comets look like. They're very peculiar objects in the solar system. Some people have said that the system of comets in the solar system is another solar system, a second solar system. They're radically different from planets, of course. Their constitution is different, their masses are different, their densities are different, and so forth, and they move at different speeds than the planets move. So they're very different than planets. Some people have, you know, thought that Venus and Mars were, you know, they're planets, of course, but they thought they were comets in the past. But if you can go by common experience as to what comets are like that we know about today, it's hard to imagine a planet having any properties that are even remotely similar to the properties of comet. Now, there are two kinds of comets that we take a look at in the sky. There are what are called short-period comets and long-period comets. The period of a comet is the length of time it takes to swing all the way around in its path or orbit about the sun. And if it's a short-period comet, it means it takes, on an average, 7 years to swing around the sun. Now, there are short-period comets that have larger periods. Halley's Comet has a larger period. And there are comets that have smaller periods, some down around 3 years or something like that. But the average value of the periods of the short-period comets would be right around 7 years. These comets are well studied, the short-period comets are, because they make so many trips around the sun during the lifetime of an observer that you have plenty of opportunities to look the comet over, establish its orbit very, very well, get upper limits on its mass, and find out quite a great deal about it. Now, there are the long-period comets, and they're very hard to find out much about. It's very hard to establish their orbits because they have such elongated orbits. They swing in very close to the sun and go very, very far out to the edge of the solar system. Their orbits are very elongated ellipses, and consequently, when the astronomer is able to see these comets, the portion of the orbit that he's looking at is very, very close to a straight line. And to get an orbit of a comet, you must have three observations, three different points in its orbit. And those points have to be along a part of the curve or part of the orbit that is curved enough that the thing is not too close an approximation to a straight line. Well, you see, if you're studying a long-period comet, any portion of the orbit, except down at perihelion, where the comet gets closest to the sun and swings around in its orbit and starts back out away from the sun, or out at aphelion, you can't even see it out at aphelion, where it swings back around, you see again, and starts back in toward the sun, unless you can measure, get the points down in there, down around perihelion, you have a hard time getting an orbit for a long-period comet, because three observations will give you nearly a straight line, and that won't help you get the orbit of a comet at all. It must be on a fairly curved position of that orbit. Otherwise, you don't have much of an orbit that will tell you a great deal. But long-period comets have periods that range all the way from about 100 years, maybe to 1 million years, for that matter, or maybe 10 million years. Needless to say, just because it has a period of 1 million years doesn't mean it's been around 1 million years. Of course, and I've made a point about that before, pendulums start swinging somewhere in their period. Well, long-period comets, it is hard to find out a great deal about them, because further, it's a rare occasion to see a long-period comet twice. You know, if it has a period of 1,000 years, or 100,000 years, or 1 million years, needless to say, an astronomer may get only one glimpse at that particular comet, since it won't be around for another try at it. So Not a great deal is known about long-period comets, but enough to arrive at some conclusions, though, about these things. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about the properties of comets, and then I will advance my argument that they show a short age for the solar system and for themselves. A comet is a very tenuous object. By that I mean it has practically no mass or matter composing it. As one astronomer said, a comet is a bag full of nothing. As another astronomer said, a comet is something that is as near nothing but yet something as an object can be. Out in the tail of a comet, you get a much better vacuum than you could produce in the best laboratory here on the Earth. Comets have masses that are on an average about a millionth to a billionth the mass of the Earth. That's the mass of an average or a typical comet. Now, you can establish upper limits to the masses of comets. It's very hard to determine the masses. Listen, in astronomy, there's no way to get the mass of an object unless it produces some effect on another object whose mass you know. And comets have been observed to go right through the moon systems of planets. For instance, Lexel's comet went right through Jupiter's moon system, didn't produce any change in those moons or Jupiter at all. Though the comet was changed rather radically in its motion, but it produced no change in those objects. Well, you see, unless it produces a change in the motion of some object for which you know the mass, you have no way of calculating the mass of that object. So all that can be done is to put an upper limit on this. If it were any larger than this, if it got within a certain distance, it would have produced this change in the orbit, say, of a moon or a planet. We passed right through the tail of Halley's comet, and all we got was a spectacular meteor shower. You know, a lot of stories written about it. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote one of his Professor Challenger books with, the scene was out passing through the tail of a comet. Well, it was Halley's comet that he was talking about. Professor Challenger was a rather grouchy professor, not very well liked by anybody, nor liking anybody. He got a few of his friends up there at his mountaintop house, and he figured when we passed through the tail of the comet, we'd breathe a lot of poisonous fumes and gases, and most people would die. Well, he had made arrangements for his friends to survive. Well, nothing happened, of course, when we passed through Halley's comet, except we got a spectacular meteor shower. Comets are rather harmless, really. And direct collisions with comets even would prove, in the main, rather harmless. I have a little bit more to say about that later on. But anyhow, I don't have much mass. And as an upper limit, their mass is about a millionth to a billionth of the mass of the Earth. That's about as large as they can be, and they may not be that large in mass, and they'd be much smaller. But if they were any larger than that, they would have produced what are called perturbative effects on the orbits of some of these objects that they passed close to, you see, in encounters in the past history of the motion of these comets that have been observed by the astronomer. So they don't have much mass. They're held together apparently very loosely. The structure of a comet consists of three parts. There is the head of the comet, which is a huge gaseous coma that surrounds what appears to be a nucleus within that head. There's a lot of argument about what the nucleus is like. Some people say that the nucleus of a comet is an iceberg with pieces of dust, chunks of dust and rock and gases, you see, embedded within that iceberg. Fred Whipple at Harvard University proposed that position. It's referred to popularly as the dirty iceberg model. And there's the other model, and the other model is the one I really believe is the correct one. The evidence is rather overwhelming for it, and that is what is referred to as the flying sandbank or flying gravel bank model, which says the nucleus is not a solid object at all, but is a loosely held conglomeration of gases and dust and chunks of rock and perhaps pieces of ice. The evidence far better, in spite of what you read in a multitude of astronomy textbooks, the evidence far better supports that position than it does Whipple's dirty iceberg model. But whether it is an iceberg or whether it is a flying gravel bank really doesn't make much difference in the arguments I'm going to present today. But you have a nucleus, you have a coma, which make up the head of the comet, and then you have the tail of a comet. And some comets don't have tails, but practically all of them do. And when you're able to see them, they have tails. Ordinarily, it's a rarity that one doesn't have a tail. The tail of the comet always points away from the sun. And when comets approach the sun, they contract in the head. When they go away from the sun, they expand. This is where they're very peculiar acting objects. Now, the angle that I'm interested in, for the moment, in regard to comets is whether their structure is able to withstand many trips around the sun. This has always been of a great deal of interest to astronomers, because astronomers on 10 different occasions have observed that comets break up into pieces. On 10 different occasions, right before the eyes of the astronomer, so to speak, in other words, right before the telescope, he has observed comets to break up into pieces. Comet Biela broke into two parts, and later on, for one trip around the sun, was two comets. Then later on, both comets completely disappeared. But anyhow, it is observed, and it's not a matter of guessing or thinking about it or hoping or speculating about it. It is observed that comets break up into pieces and that they're rather easily destroyed. When you study short-period comets, you can look at these things over and over and over, and you can see how their brightnesses are changing. And if you can relate the energy and the mass together, you can come to some conclusion as to how rapidly they're losing their mass. And, of course, matter is continually being pushed out of the head of the comet into the tail of the comet by radiation pressure of the sunlight. And then you have a solar wind blowing out of the sun. And this solar wind is blowing at a rate of about 250 miles per second to 600 miles per second. And this, of course, strips the head of the comet and moves that material back into the tail of the comet, takes it out of the comet completely, and is lost for good from the comet. Then as comets pass close to massive objects like Saturn or Jupiter and the Sun, the tidal effects of gravity, you see, exerted on the different parts of the comet tend to break it up into pieces. And so there are a number of effects that literally destroy these comets every time they make a trip around the sun. Now, if the comets, the short-period comets, let's say, to start with, originated at the same time that the solar system did, and that's the classical or traditional position regarding the origin of comets, if they were, to quote W.M. Smart in his little book, The Origin of the Solar System. Smart was longtime Astronomer Royal of Scotland. You know they had one too, but they didn't. And was professor of astronomy at the University of Edinburgh. A very famous astronomer over in that part of the world. Smart remarked that he believed comets were just the debris left over from the creation of the solar system, and that they had their origin at the same time that the solar system itself did. That is the common or traditional viewpoint regarding comets. Not all hold that position, as I'll indicate in a little bit. But if they originated at the same time that the solar system did, and you can determine the lifetimes of these comets, if they're still around, you have an upper limit on the life, you have an upper limit then on the time of origin of the comets, as well as an upper limit on the time of the origin of the solar system itself. Well, estimates have ranged over a variety of values for the lifetimes of these comets. Fred Whipple of Harvard University, who's probably the most famous American student of comets, he says that a typical short-period comet can make about 200 trips around the sun before it has lost its mass and is no longer a comet, just debris spread out over space. He says then the period of a typical short-period comet is 7 years. 7 times 200 is 1,400 years. So 1,400 years, he says, is the lifetime of a typical or average short-period comet. A Russian astronomer, who's probably the most famous Russian astronomer studying comets, a man by the name of Vysetsky, he says that 3,000 years is the lifetime of a short-period comet. And he doesn't believe short-period comets can go past 3,000 years in the time of their existence. R.A. Littleton, whom I've already mentioned to you, of Cambridge University, the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy, he says 10,000 years, and that's it. He doesn't think anything could get more than that. You couldn't get any short-period comets past 10,000 years. A German astronomer of the name of Swin at the University of Berlin, he says 25,000 years. N.T. Bobrovnikov of Ohio Wesleyan University, Perkins Observatory, he says 1,000,000 years at the most, and he says you get rid of everything. Old Fred Hall, you know, steady state fame, he says 1,000,000 years also, and you lose every comet you've got, long period, short period, or anything else. If there's any other kind around, you'll lose the whole shebang. You'll lose all of them. Now, those are the estimates. I don't think anybody's ever estimated past 1,000,000 years. Most astronomers believe that R.E. Littleton's estimate is right. About 10,000 years is the maximum lifetime of those comets, short-period comets. So, what I'm saying is, if there are any short-period comets left, and the short-period comets originated at the same time that the solar system did, and I'll present the opposing arguments, don't worry, then I'll give my opposing arguments to the opposing arguments. But anyhow, before I you think I'm signing off with just that, I'm not. There's a bit more to go here. If the short-period comets originated at the same time that the solar system did, and if there are any of them around, and if that estimate of 10,000 years is about right, and if you don't like that one, pick any of the others. The evolution's out of business. If you pick any of the others, a million years, far less than a billion years, or 2 billion, or 4.5 billion, but I think Littleton is right about it, and most astronomers, as I said, would say that Littleton's value is about the right value for this. Well, this would say that the maximum age of the short-period comets is 10,000 years, but they're any around. There are plenty of them still around. There are 160 that we know about, and it's believed that there are millions of them in the solar system that just haven't been discovered, for that matter. They're very hard to find. It used to be fairly easy. That's when they discovered all the easy ones. It's like finding oil. We used to be able to look at the slope of the ground and so forth and just about guess. I remember old H.L. Hunt one time. He was very upset with his geophysics department, you know, his oil company. And he said that he could just go out and walk around and guess at it and do better than his geophysicists were doing. Well, I doubt that very seriously, but anyhow, maybe he could. He found a lot of oil, didn't he? All over the place. Well, anyway, geophysicists don't like to hear talk like that for a minute, you know. It's at our job. Like fellow causing and handling that kind of language, you know, they can look at it and do better than we can. Well, anyhow, there are plenty of these short-period comets around, it would seem, but it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And today, astronomers don't look for them. They just happen to find them, you know, by photographing different parts of the sky. And if they photograph it over a period of time, you'll have some objects that are moving, changing their positions too rapidly to be stars, and then you figure you've either got a comet or an asteroid. Then you take a look at that object that's doing that. And today, comets are located mainly in this fashion, sort of an accident. Just shows up, and there you begin to look at it. It takes too much time if you start looking specifically for that. You can look and look. You could probably look a lifetime and never see a comet, you know, by just looking for one. And then you might, the very next night, see one. For that matter, if you happen to be looking in the right place at the right time. But you have to look a while before you'll notice that it's a comet. Well, anyhow, that's my point, that the solar system cannot be older than 10,000 years on that basis, provided the ifs I mentioned are correct. Well, let me tell you the objections to that position. Now, this dilemma has been recognized, by the way, for the astronomer who believes the evolutionist for quite a long time. And astronomers, they have a tendency to trust their comrades over in geology without really checking their assumptions and so forth that are involved in their obtaining the age of things. I once had a young man in a philosophy major in my astronomy class, and he had heard my lecture about comets and influx of cosmic dust. He was very upset. He said the geologists had proved that things were billions of years old. I asked him how. He said, well, by looking at the fossils, you could decide that. I said, how can you look at a piece of rock, decide how old it is, by just some markings in it? Pick up a trilobite, how can you tell by the shape of its head, or whatever a trilobite has on it, you know, those things coming off the side and so forth. How can you tell by just looking at a piece of rock how old something is? How can you tell by looking at two layers of rock whether the interval of time of deposition between the two layers was 30 minutes or 30 million years just by looking at the rock? If you ever find out, let me know. We'll use that method if you can do that. Well, of course, finally he ended up saying, after puzzling around with it a while, he says by radiometric dating they decide that. Well, we'll have more to say about that. But of course, the astronomer, he believes the geologist when he says 4.5 billion years or something like that. And Henry Norris Russell, you know, of Hertzsprung Russell fame again, very famous astronomer, very excellent astronomer, one of the greatest American astronomers. He wrote a little book called The Origin of the Solar System back in the early 1900s. And in this book, Russell remarked that comets were breaking up awfully fast. And he said those comets can't stay around very long. He said they'd be gone in thousands of years at the rate at which these things are breaking up. Now, that was in the early 1900s. And a tremendous amount of research has been done since that time, of course, on comets and observing these things. But that was way back there. The problem was recognized. And Russell remarked, he said, I haven't the foggiest notion how to get out of this dilemma. But he said this is a problem for future astronomers. Russell was always saying that. He was leaving that up to future astronomers to get things out of these difficulties in which they found themselves. It never seemed to occur to Russell to say, maybe that bunch of geologists are dead wrong about this. Maybe that's the answer. It never seems to occur to these people to suggest that that might be the possibility. You know, that maybe the geologists are wrong. After all, can't be right all the time, can you? Well, now and then a person misses it once in a while. So maybe those geologists slipped once upon a time and got that age wrong. I'll go sometimes. You know, it always amazes me how an archaeologist or an anthropologist can... Professor Field isn't here, yes, he's an archaeologist. But anyhow, you know you get one of these fellows standing in a cave. They see some markings there, a picture of a cow or steer. Some cattle, you know, in other words, are there. And I declare, if those folks are not able to tell you all about the society, you know, in which the ranchers who had all those cattle live, they can tell you about the customs, whether they hit their women over the head with clubs. My goodness, wouldn't it be a dangerous thing to do today, these women knowing karate and so forth? Try to hit one of them, you're liable to get murdered or killed in a hurry. They know all these martial arts so much and so forth. It's a dangerous thing, teaching women all that. He's liable to be murdered without a bit of doubt. It's a dangerous day, but I don't know whether, you know, those men dragged them around or not. Maybe it was tough then or tougher, who knows. But anyhow, these people seem to have that omniscience to be able to look at markings on caves and tell you what form of government they had. Only thing I can decide is they had some cattle, you know, and they were perhaps ranchers and things like that. But these anthropologists can tell you all about what kind of clothes they wore and the size of their heads and all that sort of thing. It's always amazing to physicists how they're able to do that. We have such a hard time on simple problems, and it always bugs us no end how they can come out working out these tough ones like they do. But anyhow, let me give you some of the objections, or some of the things that are mentioned in objection to what I have said. By the way, the Russian astronomer Beset Vyatsky, he also recognized this problem. He said, we know the solar system is very, very old, and here these comets are going to be gone, though, in just a short period of time. How can this be? If the solar system is old, we still have short-period comets. You can read this in Beset Vyatsky's early writings in regard to this problem. And others have remarked on this. The time dilemma is the trouble. This is the thing that bothers everybody. Well, here are some of the proposals. We'll go from the absurd to the absurd. The absurd to the absurd. I think it is, really. All right, the first of the absurds. It says that comets are something spewed out of the sun. Well, that's never been observed, and my goodness, you could never get the orbits like they're talking about if it was just something that was spewed out of the sun. I don't think there's anybody living and probably not dead who would remotely entertain that position. I've forgotten who it was that proposed that. I started to say Proctor, who was a British student of comets back in the 1800s. I don't think Proctor did that. Somebody else back there, I've forgotten who it was, proposed that. And nobody entertained it except that fella, and he wanted to take it back immediately, that he'd ever said it. Here are the serious proposals. The first one is this, and this is by the Russian astronomer Beset Vyatsky. I told you what he said. He remarked, the universe, the solar system is old, according to the geologists. The comets obviously cannot be old because they would have completely disappeared by now in just a short period of time, if, you know, by this breakup. So he said there must be something that continually replenishes the supply of these short period comets. Now, the various possibilities of replenishing the supply have been examined. They don't come from outside the solar system. You know, from galactic space, space within the galaxy, interstellar space, in other words. They don't come from there because the orbits are closed orbits as the comets approach the sun. If they were coming from, you know, inside the galaxy, from, you know, the vicinity of other stars or in between the stars, then the orbits of these objects as they approach the sun would have to be open orbits, hyperbolic orbits or parabolic orbits. But there's never been a single comet observed to come in on an open orbit. They're all closed orbits. Now, there have been a lot of comets seen to leave the vicinity of the sun on open orbits because the sun sort of gives them a push. You see, that speeds them up and they go out on an open orbit. But none have been observed to come in on open orbits. And so it's believed by, I think I could say 100% of the astronomers even there, that comets do not come from interstellar space. They're local to the solar system. They're part of the sun's family. They are not comets that are captured, it seems. Because if you examine the capture process, now I admit, and I don't deny this for a minute, that if a comet passes close to Jupiter or Saturn, the orbit may be changed, and you have what is called a member, a family that's a member of Jupiter's family. That doesn't mean it travels around Jupiter. It just means it travels in an orbit whose semi-major axis, which is one half of the big dimension of the orbit, is about equal to Jupiter's, the semi-major axis of Jupiter's orbit. That's all that means. Or the aphelion point, the point you see where the object is farthest from the Sun, is about the same distance that Jupiter is from the Sun. It doesn't mean that the object travels around Jupiter or anything of the sort. But the capture theory will not replenish the supply of short-period comets rapidly enough to keep this thing going over any long period of time. And the orbits don't match. The physics of the problem just will not give you this supply of comets being replenished by some kind of capture process of short-period comets from long-period comets. They won't match up, physics-wise. Now, Vysetsky, he looked into a number of these possibilities. He said there's only one possibility. He said there are volcanoes on Jupiter that are spewing out these comets. This is the only thing Vysetsky could come up with. He says there is volcanic action on Jupiter. These volcanoes are erupting on Jupiter, and the comets are coming out of there. As they come out of there, they go into orbits not about Jupiter. It's kind of hard to understand how they get away from Jupiter. But anyhow, they don't go into orbits about Jupiter. They go into orbits about the Sun. Well, Vysetsky and his followers in Russia are about the only ones. I was asked this morning about Velikovsky. Velikovsky holds to this position. Velikovsky is of Russian background, Russian origin, and he believes that Vysetsky is right about this. But when you look at the physics of the problem, it doesn't seem right at all. In the first place, Jupiter has a tremendous mass. It's hard to understand how you can get a comet at 30 kilometers per second getting out of the gravitational field of such a big, massive planet, the second most massive object in the solar system, the Sun being first. So it seems well-nigh impossible to get out of that gravitational pull of Jupiter. Secondly, the orbits do not match up with hypothetical objects that would have escaped from the gravitational field of Jupiter. Just can't get those orbits that you observe for short-period comets on the basis of their coming out of Jupiter. Then, and this is probably one of the best arguments, some people don't like this, but you see, astronomers like to see things happen. They believe strongly in this seeing business, because you know that's what astronomy is based on, looking through a telescope, taking a picture of something happening. If they don't see it happen, they don't like the idea too much. Nobody has ever seen a comet come out of Jupiter. Nobody has ever seen a comet come out of Saturn. Nobody has ever seen a comet even remotely looking like it came out of one of the moons of Jupiter or one of the moons of Saturn. By the way, if you try to get away from that gravitational problem, the pull of Jupiter, they put those volcanoes out on one of Jupiter's moons, you know, to cut down the gravity a little bit, and then they gave up on that. Nothing worked. So they decided to just go back to Jupiter and stay there with the volcanoes instead of trying to get the thing out of the moon. But anyhow, nobody's ever seen any of this happen. And astronomers take a very dim view if it doesn't match their common experience. Now, of course, one can always argue in the by and by, in the future, one will see a comet come out of Jupiter. Well, I don't know. Maybe they will. I doubt it. But maybe they will. Who knows? But that's not what we work on. You can't work on the basis of by and by in the future this may happen. You have to go over the evidence that you have at hand, you know, if you push a particular position. It may be good to say in the by and by this will happen and that will happen and we'll see this and we'll see that. That's fine, but that's nothing but science fiction, you see. Because unless you can say, I see this happening, one's in a bit of trouble in astronomy. This has never been observed. Then there are other difficulties. You know, the old view, at least when I started teaching astronomy, the view was that Jupiter was very, very cold. You know, the gaseous envelope consisting of hydrogen and helium and ammonia and methane and so forth was at an extremely low temperature. As cold as witches. There, if you're walking around on Jupiter, you'd better be dressed warmly. It's awfully cold. And the core of Jupiter, the solid part of Jupiter, is thought to just be one big iceberg. And it was awfully hard. It's awfully hard for me to understand, if that position is correct, how you get volcanoes and icebergs, you know? If volcanoes are spewing out those comets, how in the world do you get a volcano, you know, in an iceberg, you know, the solid part of Jupiter? So it was always a bit difficult for me to figure out how a volcano erupted out of an iceberg. Well, of course, if you want to take the opposite view, which is that coming out of the Pioneer probe studies, that Jupiter is like a little star, maybe, and the atmosphere is very hot, and if there's a core at all, it's about the size of our moon, or it's no larger than the size of our moon. And if you believe Whipple's dirty iceberg idea, it's hard to understand how you can get icebergs spewed out of hot stars, you know. If Jupiter is something like just a cool star, it's still plenty hot. And it is hot, if you can believe the Pioneer results. That atmosphere is nearly liquefied gas. It's at such a high temperature and a high pressure that it's gas in a liquid state, practically. It's terrifically hot. It's hard to understand how, if you believe the iceberg idea about the nucleus of a comet, how you get icebergs, you know, ice cubes spewed out of a star, out of a hot star. Of course, it's not a full-fledged star, and it may have nothing to do with a star, but it's awfully hot, the Pioneer data seems to indicate. The physics of the problem just will not match up with volcanic action on Jupiter, and furthermore, it has not been observed, and the astronomer believes, most of the time, he believes you ought to follow Occam's razor. You should not try to explain something on the basis, if you can explain it on the basis of what you see, you should not resort to things that you do not see or had any experience with in trying to frame an explanation. He doesn't always follow that. Note my following remarks. But that position is a minority viewpoint, but it's probably the only serious one other than the other one I'm going to mention that's held in trying to explain, you know, get away from this difficulty of the short-period comets disappearing so rapidly. Now, the second viewpoint is one that is really less credible, I think, at least, than the one I've just presented by Vicente Bieschi. This second viewpoint, which is very popular today, and you'll find it in 99 and 44 100% of the textbooks as the explanation for things, this was one put forth by the Dutch astronomer Oort. He was a good friend of Russell's, and Russell had suggested to Oort that he try to figure this problem out. And Oort did not come up with anything original except for the dimensions of this thing I'm going to tell you about. Oort just went back and picked up an idea that a British astronomer by the name of Pierce had put forth back in the late 1800s. He revived the idea. And Jung at Yale University in the early 1900s in this country had pushed the idea, and Oort revived it about 1950, published a paper. He published two papers. Oort published two papers, one in 1950 and one in 1963, dealing with the source of comets. Now, here's what Oort said. He said, there's a big shell. It's invisible, of course, but there's a big shell, spherical in shape, a spherical shell, way out from the sun, and this shell, its inner radius is about 50,000 astronomical units from the sun. He varied with some. In the first paper, he started out with one value, in the second paper, he decided on a different value for it. But roughly from about 50,000 astronomical units from the sun, the inner radius. Now, an astronomical unit is about 93 million miles, is 93 million miles. And he said the outer boundary of the shell is 150,000 astronomical units. It's been changed a little bit today. They brought it in a little bit closer than 150,000 astronomical units. Now, he said in the shell are about 200 billion comets. In the shell are about 200 billion comets. He says they're out there in sort of a deep freeze. Now, the deep freeze was the American paraphrasing of Oort's remarks regarding those comets. But I'll paraphrase, too. There's a deep freeze of comets out there. And as we move through space, as the solar system is dragged along with the sun, we pass close to stars that perturb the orbits of those comets out there in that big shell. And the comets then are sort of kicked out of the shell, and they come in closer, you see, to the sun. They come out of the shell. Now, they're in that shell, a big old shell, you know, all the comets there are swinging around the sun. They're swinging around with orbits that have different periods, of course. The shell doesn't swing like a big solid, but all the parts are traveling around the sun. But due to perturbative effects of nearby stars, or stars that we passed close to in our travel around the center of the galaxy in the local solar neighborhood, you get those comets coming out of there, and their orbits change a little bit, and they evolve, pardon the phrase, evolve into short-period comets. This is what Oort said. He said, you're continually then getting the supply, the number of short-period comets resupplied, and they will not run out during the lifetime of the solar system because you've got plenty of those long-period comets out there. Well, Sounds like a great idea. Except, you know, in science, supposedly, you're guilty until you're proved innocent. Which means, until you can advance evidence for your position, it is merely a position and nothing more. And does not even, it is not relegated to the level of a theory until there is some evidence for it. Now, Oort's position starts off rather poorly, because you see, he had to put that shell so far out that you can't see the thing. See, if you put it any closer, you can start seeing these comets. You've got 200 billion worth of them out there. That's a lot of comets. That's more comets than you've got stars in our galaxy. You need to remember, in our galaxy, it's thought to be about 100 billion stars. Well, Oort is putting in this shell 200 billion comets. He didn't do anything in little amounts. He's putting 200 billion more stars than in the galaxy. He's putting more comets out there in that shell. Well, he couldn't put the thing in any closer because you could see the thing, perhaps, you know. Nobody's seen it. And astronomers always are uneasy, you know. They have an uneasy feeling if you don't see these things. Bothers them a little bit. It doesn't bother them too much in this case, but nonetheless gives some of them a rather uneasy feeling. But anyhow, he put it there. And then he didn't dare put that shell any farther out, because if he put it any farther out, some of these passing stars would pick the thing up, you know, and just drag it off. If a star coming close, you drag the thing away, and it's goodbye comets. Goodbye shell, 200 billion worth of you. If you pass too close to a nearby star, if you put it too far out there, you get out beyond what's called the Roche limit of stability for the solar system, and the comets will be picked up by something else. They'll travel around some other star in the galaxy rather than our sun. So he did it that way. Here's how he arrived at that shell. He plotted what's called the binding energy of a comet. The binding energy of a comet is the energy with which the solar system holds it to itself. He plotted the binding energy versus the number of comets possessing a certain binding energy. The binding energy is inversely proportional to a quantity called A, the semi-major axis of the orbit, which is related to the farthest distance that the comet is from the sun. Now, he used very poor data. He had only about 40 comets to start with in this problem. And the interval for plotting his graph, you know, that he claimed showed the comets were out there in the shell, the interval he used was at the same level of the accuracy of the data that he was using. Well, you can't work that way. You can't use it as an interval for the plotting of your graph. You know, right down there, the size of the error that is probable in your data. Well, he started out that way. So most self-respecting astronomers, if they had any respect in regard to this matter, would have said, that's enough right there. You can't do that sort of thing. Because the error that is present in your measurements is on the same order of magnitude as the interval that you're using for the plotting of your graph. That right there is enough to... We could stop right there, really. That would be enough to kick out the curve that he drew. But everybody had an axe to grind in this matter, and those comets were a bothersome thing. Here are these geologists hollering and screaming. They're 4.5 billion years old. And who wanted to take that crowd on, you know? And so you had to get that thing somehow or other fixed up to suit them. 10,000 years that Littleton was talking about sure wasn't going to go over good at the local geological petroleum club and so forth, and didn't like that value one bit. So you had to do something with this thing, the idea was. So he went on ahead with that. Then, of course, Oort never bothered to point out that any time a comet makes a trip around the sun, the binding energy changes far larger than, again, that interval of measurement that Oort was using. In other words, that one of those comets makes a swing around the sun, and your binding energy had changed immensely. And there was the question which Oort very conveniently overlooked. Oort assumed that every comet of those 40, see, the 40 that he studied were the only ones that they had orbits for, they were long-period comets, and the only ones they had orbits for. And a lot of people were unsatisfied with those orbits. But he only had 40, and so here's what he assumed. He assumed every one of those 40 were making their first trip, you see, down close to the sun. They'd been traveling out in that shell, and he assumed that all 40 of those, and you remember, they're the only 40 we had orbits for. He just took the whole bunch and he said, I assume every one of those have just left the shell. Well, how in the world do you prove such a thing as that? You see, that is a glaring assumption Why, that's a terrible assumption to make, such a thing as that. Because, you see, if the binding energy changes sometimes as much as 100% even, if the binding energy with each trip changes that way, well, you can have that whole thing change with one trip. And there's no way in the world to plop back. You hear so much talk about this working backwards in time in astronomy. Listen, astronomical orbital equations blow up very easily when you work backward in time because they involve quantities that will throw singularities and discontinuities into your equations. How in the world, if you know the binding energy right now, do you promise that this is really honest-to-goodness initial binding energy of that thing if you don't know for sure how many trips it's made? Well, Oort was desperate. He only had 40 comets. He needed all the binding energies and comets he could get, so he said, I just assume the whole shebang represents comets that just came out of the shell. Well, that is extremely poor procedure and sloppy work. But forget about that. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say, all right, we'll forget about all the sins that you have committed in violation of the scientific approach and good numerical calculation and everything else, and assume you're right about that. But here's what you can do. There's a basic error further in Oort's approach. The way the function that Oort plotted versus number of comets, he plotted such a function that it doesn't make any difference what numbers he had. You will always get this function showing a concentration of numbers of these objects at large distances from the sun. It was a function. You can repeat this thing. You can take any kind of distribution of numbers or distribution of objects that you please. And if you use the kind of function that Oort used to try to prove his position, my goodness, I must be doing something wrong here. I think I'm standing too close or something. Well, anyhow, with the kind of function that he used, you get the same answer he gets no matter what the situation is. You can have the comets distributed uniformly in space. You can have them bunched up anywhere you please, and you're always going to get the same answer with the approach that Oort used. And what Oort should have done was plotted the thing that is the direct determiner of the number of aphelion points that you have at a particular place in space. You see, if you're going to prove the existence of a shell, you have to show that what is called the space density of the aphelion points. Now, space density means the number of aphelion points per unit volume of space. You have to show that you have a space density concentration out there in that shell he's talking about. Now, the thing that the space density is directly proportional to is this thing called the semi-major axis of the orbit in which the object is traveling. If you make a plot of the number of comets per aphelion distance, A, or semi-major axis of the orbit, you don't find any concentration at all. You find that these aphelion points, you see the points where the comets are farthest from the sun, are just scattered all over. And there is no concentrating effect whatsoever. They're here and there, and there is no shell in existence anywhere. They do not concentrate in any kind of volume of space. They're spread out all over the solar system. In other words, the mathematics of this problem, coupled with the observations, shows that there is no shell in existence at all, and that Oort is wrong. Well, Oort's come under a lot of fire here lately, but he still has a powerful lot of followers. By the way, you can go further in this problem. That is enough. But anyhow, you could examine the physics of it. And by the way, if you wanted to get those comets, I think this is very important, if you wanted to get those comets out of that shell fast enough, you're going to have 100 stars in closer to us than the nearest star is to us, Alpha Centauri. Well, unless those stars are invisible, there's nothing between here and Alpha Centauri. It's empty once you get out of the solar system. If there are any stars between here and there, they're invisible. Well, of course, you can throw in your black holes if you want to, but boy, if they're that close, you can be uneasy tonight. And we'll be sleeping good for a while if they're that close to us. Because we get around the edge of one of those things, we'll be sucked right into them, so I hope they're not. There are no so-called black holes around. But you'd have to, if there were that shell, there's not. Now, the physics is good, there's just not that shell. If you can believe the physics of the problem, now if you don't want to believe that, all right. But if you can believe the physics of the problem, then the shell is not there. But suppose it were there. You would have to have 100 stars, at least, within one parsec of distance of the Earth. A parsec is 3.31 light years. You'd have to have 100 stars within that distance of the sun in order to kick those stars out of that hypothetical shell, or kick those comets out of there fast enough to keep this supply from disappearing completely. And one other thing. With the present boundaries on that shell, or it's going to have to move that thing in a little closer, because with the present boundaries even, he's in trouble. The celestial mechanics of the problem shows that it could be picked up easily by another star. So they're going to have to make a revision in their position. They're going to have to bring that thing in still some closer. What I'm saying is this. At the present time, and one can say, of course, in the by and by, this will be found out and that will be found out, but at the present time, there is no known mechanism for replenishing the supply of short-period comets. And most astronomers still believe that the big majority of your comets, but they want to put them out in that shell, originated at the same time the solar system did. But you see, they want to kick them out of that shell. But the shell does not exist. It seems to me the position that the short-period comets indicate a young age for the solar system is a correct position. It appears to me that on the basis of the breakup of the short-period comets, the comets can be no older than 10,000 years, and consequently the solar system itself can be no older than 10,000 years at a maximum. Let's take right quickly a look at the long-period comets. I'll just give you a few calculations about these things. If you took a typical long-period comet that has a period of about 100,000 years, take one like that, 100,000 years, it'd make 45,000 trips around the sun, wouldn't it, in that alleged lifetime of the solar system of 4.5 billion years. 100,000 divided in 4.5 billion, I hope that comes out 45,000. Anyway, you'd make about 45,000 trips around the sun. That long-period comet would have to have a mass several times larger than the mass of the sun in order to last through 45,000 trips. And Oort says you've got 200 billion worth of those things out there, you know, moving around. If that is the case, and the mechanics is the mechanics of the problem, and of course I know you can make equations say anything, but after a while, everybody gets pinned down on things. You can't just get by with anything after a bit. But anyhow, in a multiple system of objects, the smaller objects in mass travel around the larger objects mass-wise. Isn't that right? If the comets have a larger mass than the sun would have to travel around those comets, you see. But the comets travel around the sun. But you could not get those comets, a typical long-period comet, lasting. Suppose that appeared as high as 100,000 years. That's a large one. Take one down with 100 years, it's going to make a lot more trips. Just take one at 1 million years, it'll make fewer trips, I agree. But you're bound to have a whole bunch of them at 100,000. Those things are going to have masses larger than the several times, not just a little bit larger, not just a tenth of a kilogram larger, but several times multiples of the mass of the sun in order to last throughout that alleged lifetime. It would seem to me then that the rapid breakup of comets indicates a very young age for the solar system, a young age for the comets themselves, and consequently if the comets originated at the same time the solar system, as W.M. Smart maintains and has been the traditional view of astronomers in regard to this matter, then the solar system itself cannot be very old. It would have to be quite young as well. I think I'll mention one more thing here that would indicate a young age for the Earth. If you take a look at the helium in the Earth's atmosphere, this has always been an interesting problem. When I first began looking at this matter of time myself, is one of the first things that occurred to me. I had a rather unsuccessful approach at it. Helium is generated in the Earth's atmosphere due to the decay of radioactive elements in the crust of the Earth, in the granite, which seems to be, at least on the basis of what we know in boreholes and so forth, where the radioactive minerals are located in the granite, doesn't seem to be anything practically in the basalts and so forth. But anyhow, when uranium decays, and thorium and so forth, you get helium as one of the daughter elements that are formed. And then, you have helium pouring into the Earth's atmosphere out of natural gas wells and so forth. If you make a calculation as to the total amount of helium that should be in the Earth's atmosphere, and the amount that is, if you measure through altitude rockets and so forth, you measure the amount of helium that is in the Earth's atmosphere, you find that you have only about 1 millionth of the amount of helium that you should have. You have only about 1 millionth of the amount of helium that you should have. And of course the question arises, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, where is all the helium, you see, that should be in the Earth's atmosphere? Back when I was a student, they were claiming that helium atoms collided with metastable oxygen atoms in the upper atmosphere, got energy, enough energy to overcome the gravitational pull of the Earth and reach the escape velocity for the Earth, and they got out of the Earth's atmosphere and you lost your helium in that manner. It was also claimed that the sun acted peculiar off and on and heated up the upper portion of the Earth's atmosphere, gave those particles a lot more energy, and the helium escaped. However, when you look at the rate at which helium is pouring into the Earth's atmosphere, you take in consideration all possible mechanisms that the physicists have been able to dream up about the way helium could escape. A professor of mine, one summer I took a course, I was doing some work on the Derby earthquakes up near Denver, and decided I'd just take a course in planetary atmospheres over at the University of Colorado. They had a man from NASA there, a fellow named Ian Rasu, teaching a course in the atmospheres of planets. He made this statement. He said the Earth would have had to lose its atmosphere 20 times in order to come up with the amount of helium, the small amount of helium, to account for the very small amount of helium that the Earth's atmosphere has on the basis of the Earth being 4.5 billion years old. It takes a lot to get an atmosphere away from a planet, too, you know. That's a major undertaking. You have to have energy sources for doing these things. You just can't say a planet loses its atmosphere like that, you know. And presto, that's not an antifreeze. It's an old magic word. Presto, the atmosphere disappears. All right, so when you take in consideration all the mechanisms for the possible laws, you take in consideration all of the amount that's coming in, and by the way, it's coming in meteorites and everything, pouring in quite great quantities, you get an upper limit for the age of the atmosphere of about 10 to 12,500 years on the basis of the amount of helium that is there. Taking in consideration influx and efflux, the escape and the amount of helium that is coming in, you can calculate the age of the Earth's atmosphere as being about 10,000 to 12,500 years. So when you look at some of the elements in the Earth's atmosphere, it seems to me at least that you come to a conclusion the atmosphere is quite young. When you take a look at the breakup of those short-period comets, one must come to the conclusion the comets and the solar system are young, and the Earth being a part of the solar system consequently is young. All right, he says, all signals go for the second part of my lecture now. All right, that's the main attraction. Now we'll take the selected short subjects here for the remaining. Now, I need a little more time. I've got to have some more time here, so I've got one more lecture to go tomorrow. We'll try to squeeze some questions in if we can there, but I need some more time. I took too long on those comets. But I want you to kind of understand the arguments, you see, about these comets. So that's why I took so much time. It's a very important argument, I think. Well, I need to tell you some other things, and if I get through telling this in a hurry, then we'll have some time for questions, but I need to mention another thing or two. That helium problem, I just hurried right through it there. That's a very important aspect of this problem. It's been worked many, many times. By the way, old Henry Norris Russell again, in his Origin of the Solar System, he's a source book of all the troubles. If you want to find out all the troubles astronomers and geologists have been having, read his Origin of the Solar System. He tells all of the secrets that everybody likes to keep quiet. He tells them all in that book. My first thoughts regarding helium were provoked by remarks in Russell's book, in which he said there's not enough helium in the atmosphere for the Earth to be 4.5 billion years old. Hence, again, always the geologist is right. He's Mr. Clean in all of this. He is always right. And Russell said there must be an escape mechanism. He was the one who suggested the collision of helium particles with metastable oxygen atoms. I decided I'd write a little paper on it. When I first went down to what was called then Texas Western College, I thought I'd write a paper on that. So I wrote one and examined this collision approach between the helium particles and the oxygen atoms, and it turned out that you couldn't get rid of the helium that way at all. You just get rid of small quantities of it, not nearly enough by that approach. So I sent the paper in to the American Journal of Physics, which is a publishing organ for American Association of Physics Teachers, and after a while I got a letter back from a fellow at Michigan State. He said the paper had been turned over him to read. He was the referee on matters of that nature. And he said what I ought to do was read James Jeans' books on kinetic theory of gases, and I'd have the answer as to where the helium had gone. Well, of course, I had read Jeans' book. It's a classic in that field in which he first examines the problem of the escape of atmospheres from planets. You can calculate, you know, the length of time it'll take for an atmosphere to escape and so forth, what the conditions would have to be for it to escape. Well, there was, of course, little point in sending the paper back to him. So I just put it in the file. 10 years later, I noticed a paper was published in Nature by Dr. Melvin Cook of the University of Utah. Same subject, and came to the same conclusions, and they had published his paper. I was glad to see it published. I felt a little bit bad about it, in a way. Mine coming to the same conclusions, going through, well, not quite the same calculations, a different approach, and mine had gotten chopped off early, but I was glad he got his paper through. It's published in Nature, and his conclusion was those figures I gave you, 10 to 12,000 years, was about what he concluded in that paper, and you can read it in Nature. That was about 10 years after I'd had my try with a paper on that, and I don't remember who the rascal was up at Michigan State. I'd like to get one of his papers. I advise him to read something or the other. Well, anyhow, I don't even remember his name. It's been so long ago now. It was a long, long time ago. But anyway, it's a very important part of this problem, the constituents of the atmosphere. Well, I haven't gone overtime, have I? Oh, I got about 20 minutes left, right? Okay. All right. Well, anyhow, one more thing I'll tell you about, and then if there's time left over for questions, we'll talk some about it. If not, well, you can lay for me tomorrow. You'll have really a bunch of them by tomorrow, then, if you mull over all this business all night. I should get these questions immediately when they're easy. Easier. Relative, that's a relative statement. The time you think about it all night, you come up some tough ones. Well, anyhow, I want to tell you about the work of a colleague of mine. I mentioned this briefly yesterday. Dr. Tom Barnes, who's a member, we're both members of the physics faculty at the University of Texas at El Paso. I told you yesterday, I think, that Horace Lamb, a British physicist, late 1800s, lived quite a ways down to the 1900s. Old physics professors took Lamb's books and used them in their mechanics courses. I said this one time that I'd used Lamb's books, and there's some fella. He said he was a young physicist. He'd never heard of Lamb's books. But anyhow, those of us who came up in the Dark Ages, we used Lamb's very famous two volumes on statics and dynamics, and they were excellent. Lamb, back in the 1800s, got curious about this magnetic field. You know, the Earth possesses a magnetic field. By saying that the Earth possesses a magnetic field, I mean that it acts like it has a huge bar magnet embedded within it. And, you know, if you get in the vicinity of a bar magnet and you have a piece of metal, say a piece of iron, it'll be attracted to that magnet. If you sprinkle out some iron filings, you know, they'll arrange themselves in a particular pattern about that magnet. Or if you bring a conductor that has a current traveling in it in the vicinity of that magnet, there'll be a force exerted on that conductor. Magnetic fields are just volumes of space in which magnetic forces are exerted on objects brought into that vicinity of space. That's all you mean by a magnetic field. If there were a magnet in here, then some little charged particle came in the vicinity of this magnet, moving along, it would have a force exerted on it if it were moving. All right, it'd have a force exerted on it. Well, this is all I mean by a magnetic field. The Earth acts as if it has a bar magnet embedded within it. This bar magnet, sitting at about an angle of 11 degrees to the axis of rotation, the center of the magnet's offset from the center of the Earth about 300 kilometers or thereabouts, something like that. Now, don't think that I'm proposing seriously there's an actual bar magnet in there. You understand. Somebody go out here and say, I said there's a bar magnet inside the Earth. There's not, that anybody knows of, at least. But the Earth acts as if it had a bar magnet inside it. Well, Gauss, I think it was, in 1835, made the first measurement of the strength of the field, how strong it was. And, whether he made the first measurement or not, he's the one who built or designed the building of the first magnetometer for the measurement of this field or a component of the field. And since about 1835 down to 1865, people made, or rather 1965, and down to present time for that matter, people have been measuring the change in the magnetic field, whether it's staying constant or whether it is changing. Now, when Horace Lamb, and I've mentioned this briefly yesterday, I think, when Horace Lamb looked at the problem, he started looking at it around 1880 or something, somewhere thereabouts, and Lamb said that the field is decaying, getting smaller in size, and he said it's decaying in a linear fashion. It's going down in a linear fashion. In other words, if you plotted strength of the field versus time, it would be a straight line. This is what you mean. And it slopes downward since the field is getting weaker and weaker as time increases. Well, it slopes downward the other way. Well, anyhow, it slopes downward, whichever way you're looking at it. If you look here on the downside, it looks like sloping upward. If you're on the upside and look down, it's sloping downward. Well, depending on your frame of reference there. Anyhow, the field is decaying. And Lamb reasoned, this was back in the 1880s, and I've forgotten exactly the date of the publication of the paper and the Philosophical Transactions, but Lamb said, all right, the field is decaying. It must have been stronger in the past. If it's weaker now, as we measured it down since 1835, it must have been stronger in the past if it's getting weaker. So he said, what I will do is work backward in time then, extrapolate, and that's an extrapolation, I agree. He said, I'll extrapolate backward in time and calculate how strong it would be at such and such day, at times, in the past. And he said, furthermore, I will make this assumption that the field originated at the same time that the planet did. Well, I think nearly everybody, regardless of which side of the fence they're on, would say that's reasonable, regardless whether they're evolutionists or creationists or whatever they happen to be. He said, a planet can only hold a field of a certain size. He says, larger than this, he doubted that a planet could hold this field, unless it were solid 100% magnetic material or something. So he said, on the basis of my calculations, he published the paper and all of that, he said the Earth is about 300,000 years old, no more. That's about the age of it. Well, I told you already about Kelvin and Lamb and the furor they stirred up. Well, Lamb's paper was ignored in comparison to what Kelvin had said. Nobody seemed to pay a nickel's worth of attention to Lamb on this matter, and the whole thing was buried. The Society of Exploration Geophysicists in Tulsa published, in the late 60s, two volumes called Exploration Mining Geophysics. Volume 1, Volume 2. Volume 1, Case Histories. Volume 2, The Theory Behind Looking for Minerals in Ore Bodies by Physical Means. And in a paper on electromagnetic prospecting, there was a very brief reference to something Lamb had said. Jacobs of the University of British Columbia said, Horace Lamb, in such and such a date, 18-something or the other, said that on the basis of the decay of the Earth's magnetic field, the Earth was no older than 300,000 years. He said we know better today because by radiometric means it's been established that the Earth is at least 4.5 billion years old. And he just went on then, and that was all. Well, Professor Barnes, his field is electricity and magnetism, and he was doing some consulting work for Globe Exploration Company at the time, and he happened to see that and thought he had run down what Lamb had to say, and he read the paper. He told me it's like translating from Chaucer. Reading everything, that goes a bit farther back than Lamb, but apparently he wrote like Chaucer. Maybe not as poetic, but... Dr. Barnes told me that it was quite a chore to just figure out what Lamb was saying, for sure. But when he translated it into modern English, so to speak, he was terribly excited over Lamb's results. And so he decided to run the data all the way, you see, past what Lamb had done, down to the last data that had been published, which was 1965, and see what the field was doing. Now, others have done this to some extent. Chapman, longtime professor of geophysics, University of Alaska, probably the most famous student of geomagnetism, he had stated in one of his textbooks, two-volume book called Geomagnetism, he wrote with Bartels, he said that the Earth's field is decaying about 5% per century or something like that. So he's already recognized that it was going down rapidly. Dr. Barnes got one of our math professors to take the data, use curve fitting techniques, put it on a computer and see what kind of curve he could arrive at, you see, for the way the field was decaying. He got an exponential decay, to make a longer story much shorter. He got an exponential decay. Now, to say it's an exponential decay means that it has a half-life. It's very similar to the decay of the radioactive element. He calculated the half-life of the field strength to be 1,400 years. That's very fast decay, of course. See, an exponential curve comes down, then tends to flatten out and stay and change very little down the lower part of the curve. Well, he got a half-life of 1,400 years. So Dr. Barnes then decided to project also back in time. Let's see how far back we could go as to what the strength of the field would be at different times. Now you say, well, you fellows are doing exactly the same thing these evolutionists are doing. Well, how in the world do you test an idea? You assume it's correct. Then you look for what? Following those assumptions down, what you've assumed the model to be correct, you look for contradictions in it. And see, you see what kind of results it leads to. Does it lead to a contradiction? Is it illogical? Does it lead to things that are unreasonable on the basis of the data? How in the world do you ever decide whether a model is true or false? If you don't assume it's true, when I say assume it's true, I don't mean that you literally assume it's true. You just assume it is true for what? Working purposes. And test it then to see if you can find anything wrong with it. This is how you test any idea. When Newton said F equals MA, how in the world do you think anybody ever decided F was equal to MA? Well, what they did, they put a little cart on a track, gave it some mass, then gave it a push and saw what kind of an acceleration it got. In other words, you check that thing out by changing the mass or changing the force or something to see if F equals MA. This is where you test an idea, of course, to see whether it's true or not. So there's nothing wrong really with this approach. I've heard people say that you're doing just like the evolutionists. Well, no. We're pushing this thing back just to see what it leads to. And if it leads to trouble, good, in this case. Well, anyhow, I'm teasing you a little bit. Good anyway, though. Well, here's what he found. He found if you go back to 10,000 years, 10,000 B.C., you would have a magnetic field for the Earth that was stronger than the magnetic field between the pole pieces of a modern radar set. And that's a tremendously strong field. I don't think you can find an astronomer anywhere who believe a planet would have a field that strong, really. If you push it back to 20,000 B.C., you get an even stronger field, and you're going to get a field, even if you go back that far, that's far more than most galaxies have, even. You know, galaxies, as I told you yesterday, have magnetic fields. You get a magnetic field that is stronger than the magnetic field of most galaxies. You get a magnetic field that's stronger than the magnetic fields of most magnetic stars. You know, they're very peculiar stars. They have rather strong magnetic fields. I don't think you'd find a geophysicist who would believe that you could have fields, you know, anywhere approaching the field of a magnetic star. If you go back to a million B.C., as that movie said, a million years B.C., go back to a million B.C., if I remember the number correctly, you have a strength for the field that is 10 to the 215th power Tesla. That's impossible, of course. So the point that Dr. Barnes is making, it is impossible, you see, to go back very far in time and have a field, a magnetic field existing for the planet that is even remotely reasonable for a planet to have. So, what this is getting at, it's impossible to set an exact age on this, but you're getting a field around 10 to 12,000 years that is considered reasonable for a planet to have. You go beyond that, it's considered unreasonable. Of course, you may say unreasonable or not, maybe it had it, but suit yourself on that. At least on the viewpoint of most people, and as I say, on either side of the fence, you know, nobody's going to believe you're going to have a planet with too large a magnetic field that compares with the order of magnitude that a magnetic star has. I don't think you're going to run into anybody who agree that you could have one. So if you run this back in time, you get a magnetic field that is too large if you go very far back. In other words, if you go back much past 10 to 12,000 years, you're really getting into a strong magnetic field that's too strong, at least in the belief of most people. Now, maybe it's possible. You can take your choice on that. Maybe it is possible, but you're running into a lot of trouble, a lot of difficulties in this regard. Now, of course, some people argue that, well, it's obvious there are magnetic reversals, you know, and if the field was strong at one time, weak at another time, and disappeared at other times, and then came back, and so forth. All right, if you want to argue that way, or if you want to cite these people who argue in that fashion, they have the burden of proof on them to show how you can reverse a magnetic field and then start it back up with an opposite direction so far as the vector is concerned. Listen, that's a tough job. You've got to turn that thing around, the vector, the field vector, get it turned around so that everything is in the opposite direction. And that may sound nice on paper. I'd like to see anybody go through the equations for doing it. It's no light chore to get a magnetic field turned around. Harold Jeffries in the Gifford Lectures at Oxford University, he was one who never held to the plate tectonics idea. I know that's very popular. I risked my reputation as well as my life, perhaps, on criticizing the plate tectonics idea and all these continents moving around. Nonetheless, Jeffries criticized it. He said, when you take in consideration the elastic constants that the crust of the Earth has, you can't move these continents around. And the elastic constants are well determined physically on the basis of the moon's orbital motion about the Earth. And, of course, everybody said to Jeffries, what about the magnetic reversals? Well, Jeffries said he didn't know what caused that particularly, but he said he did not believe you could have shifting continents because of the mechanics of the problem and the physical constants. Of course, the French physicist Nael, in a series of papers in applied physics, he said that there are five different mechanisms as to how you can have a reversal of a field locally. Not a reversal of the main field, but a reversal of the component of the field locally. And it has been certainly discovered in a number of rocks where you have a small section of rock, the same rock, just a few centimeters long, and on one end of the rock the field is aligned, the particles are aligned in one direction, indicating the direction of the field was in such and such direction. But then on the very end, separated only by a few centimeters, the field is turned in the opposite direction on that side. Now this certainly, since the particles are in the same rock, separated by only a few centimeters, the same composition of the rock, certainly couldn't have been the reversal of the main magnetic field of the Earth, because you should have had all the particles then lined up in the same direction, in that lava rock that had solidified. Nael, he has five different mechanisms. He says you can get those things turned around, which to some people they'd call a magnetic reversal, and he says it is not a reversal of the main magnetic field of the Earth. One other aspect of this problem, and I'll quit here shortly. There's a lot of question as to what causes the magnetic field of the Earth. Some people at first said it was caused because the Earth is filled with a magnetic material. Well, if you take a look at the distribution of magnetic material in the crust of the Earth, there's not nearly enough of this magnetic material around to give you the magnetic field of the Earth. And the magnetic material cannot go very deep because when the temperature goes up, the field, you see, in the material disappears. So you can't have magnetic material as such existing at depths where you would have high temperatures, because you get up to 400 to 700 degrees for some kinds of rocks and you'll lose the magnetism of those rocks then. You see, if you have a lava pouring out on the Earth, it does not have a magnetic field associated with it. And the little particles in there tend to align themselves up with the field of the Earth. And when the rock solidifies, then you have those particles aligned in a particular direction. The field is frozen into the rocks then, so to speak. If you heat that thing back up, then the field will vanish, you see, and those particles will just realign themselves according to the field that exists at that time. Well, no one, I don't think, believes that the magnetic field is caused by the presence of magnetic material as such in great quantities. There just doesn't seem to be enough of it, if you can believe the exploration geophysicists as they go around looking for minerals and oil and trying to find rocks that have magnetic properties. The two other ideas, one is that self-generating dynamo idea that says the core of the Earth acts like a big dynamo. And due to the rotation of the Earth and so forth, it is maintained that this dynamo keeps generating energy. It never runs down. Well, it's got to run down sometime if that field's going to get reversed. It's going to have to run down sometime and things are going to have to get reversed, but these people say it can go on and on and on and on. T.G. Calling, the British physicist, proved that using Maxwell's equations and so forth, that you couldn't have a self-generating dynamo operating in the Earth. But geologists still talk about self-generating dynamos in the Earth. Physics of it says no, that can't be. Most geophysicists today believe that the magnetic field is generated by the flow of currents in what is essentially a core that has certain properties of a fluid. And I say that it has certain properties of a fluid because shear waves, earthquake shear waves, will not travel through the core of the Earth or a portion of the core of the Earth. They're bent away from that area and will not travel right on through it. A shear wave, a wave that changes the shape of something, will not propagate through a fluid. It takes a rigid body for a shear wave to travel through it, or a rigid material. Most geophysicists believe you have electrical currents then, you see, actually traveling through the core of the Earth. And with an electrical current, of course, you have a magnetic field associated with it. Bring a compass in the vicinity of a conductor that has a current traveling in it, and you'll see the needle of the compass swing around some. There's a force exerted on that compass needle. Well, the point I'm getting at is this. If that is the way the magnetic field is generated, and no one knows for sure, but if that's the way it is generated, as these currents travel in the core of the Earth, they meet a resistance to their motion. And when they meet a resistance to their motion, the energy that they possessed is given up as heat energy. You know, when you turn the burner on, or the iron, or whatever you call it, on the stove, into high, after a while it's red hot, isn't it? And of course you had electrical energy converted into heat energy in that case. Well, the same thing would be happening in the Earth if this is the way the magnetic field is generated. That current is directly proportional, or rather the heating effect is directly proportional to the square of the size of the current, you see, that is causing the magnetic field. Dr. Barnes calculates, and I'm just hurrying through this and briefly mentioning some of the points. Dr. Barnes calculates that if you go back to around to 20,000 BC, you would have enough heat generated by these currents, the heating effect you see of these currents, that you could separate the core from the mantle. Well, if you can do that, it's going to be rough sledding up here on top. At a million BC, you'd have enough heat that you could vaporize the Earth. You'd have enough heat there generated by these currents that you could actually vaporize the Earth. This is what he calculates. So I think his work has tremendous significance in this whole thing. Some people would say, well, 100 years worth of data is not much data, you know. But all right, can you tell me much in geology that has more actual live, real live data? You know, going out and looking at a rock and two or three people saying that rock looks slanted this way to me, and another fellow saying it looks slanted that way to me, and another one saying it's bent instead of being slanted, it's bent such and such. That is a persuasive type of evidence. This is evidence that comes from the actual reading of an instrument. I don't care whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist. Everybody reads a magnetometer as you cross-eyed or something or the other. Reads a magnetometer the same way, and you get the same numbers off the thing. This is hard data that is actually coming from a measurement of something that is really happening before your eyes, so to speak. Of course, if one believes the evolutionists, you would think they were back there with alley-oop, you know, as the dinosaurs splashed around in the water and chomped on the grass and seaweed and all that sort of thing. But here you have something that is actual data that has been collected by a real live witness, you know, witness to what that instrument is doing in response to the magnetic field. I think that's excellent data. And that's far more data than these geologists have to go on that you would call coercive data. You know, there are two kinds of evidence, persuasive evidence and coercive evidence. Persuasive evidence means what? There are a number of interpretations that might persuade you to different positions, depending on maybe your own position somewhat. But coercive evidence is one that what? Coerces you into one position. Coercive evidence is what? Like the shadow cast on the moon. You know, when light is blocked off from the sun. Listen, there are not many things to make a shadow like the one you see that the Earth casts on the moon. The Earth has to be roughly spherical in shape. Nothing else you can find that will cast a shadow with a shape that's on the moon. That's coercive evidence. Well, I think magnetic field changes is much more coercive, relatively speaking, than some of these other lines of evidence.